You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello there, and thank you for downloading The Agenda's podcast from today, the 14th of June. And we discussed dengue on the show today. That is as global public health expert, a warning of a great prevalence of the disease around the world, and it's due to global warming. Even European holidaymakers are being warned of an uptick in tiger mosquitoes who spread the disease. We found out more about how it spreads and how you can avoid it with Marianne Comparé, who is director and co-founder of the International Society for Neglected Tropical Diseases. And we also heard from Lucy, who caught it here a few months ago. Meanwhile, the long-awaited Euros are finally here. Football agent and entrepreneur Saif Ruby talked us through the tournament ahead of that kickoff. And new stats are suggesting that the GCC is lagging behind the global curve when it comes to curbing smoking. So how does it look here in the UAE? We spoke to tobacco researcher Andrea Yabari-Leinberger. Meanwhile, as we all build up to our Eid breaks and our summer holidays, I wonder whether any of us have given any thought to how eco-friendly our flights will be. I think it's fair to say that considering the text I got today, not very many people are considering it. At least in the meantime, Emirates have actually been looking into it because they are powering flights from Singapore with sustainable aviation fuel provided by a company called Neste. They're Finnish. We found out more with their VP of Renewable Aviation Business. Plus, flight prices are soaring almost by 300% to some destinations this Eid. Producer Jennifer Crichton had the latest on whether you might be able to pick up a cheap holiday in time for the break. Hello there and welcome back to your Agenda programme. And if you are planning to travel to Europe this summer, public health officials have actually issued a warning because there is a rising prevalence of dengue on the continent. Apparently it's due to an invasive species of mosquitoes. They're called tiger mozzies. Well, I mean tiger mosquitoes. And apparently they can now be found in 13 countries in the EU, including France, Spain and Greece. And that is apparently all due to climate change. Officials as far north as Paris, where the Olympic Games is going to take place in July, are apparently monitoring the insect. Now, here in the UAE, the authorities actually worked really hard after those recent historic storms that we had to clear the standing floodwater, which of course makes a perfect breeding ground for all breeds of mosquitoes. Back during the floods, or just after the floods, we spoke to Her Excellency Alia Abdul Rahim Al-Hammoudi. Now, she's from the Ministry of Climate Change and Environment. And she told us that historically, mosquitoes weren't a problem in the UAE.
Recently, we have noticed that the activity of these mosquitoes is spreading around after the rainfall. And even, you know, with the development projects, there are a lot of water bodies. We need to remove the water bodies from all the locations. Meanwhile, we can just use our technology in order to spread the approved material in order to stop the spread of these or the activities of these mosquitoes. We need to enhance even the awareness of the communities regarding how we have to deal with these stagnant water bodies in order to stop any location that can be used as a breeding ground for these mosquitoes.
So as you can hear there, UAE authorities very much on top of any sort of mosquito-borne illness, dealing with the water that could actually provide them with a breeding ground. In the meantime, World Dengue Day will be marked globally tomorrow. Public health campaigners say it is the perfect opportunity to raise awareness of the disease. And in fact, joining me now on the line to talk through the dangers posed by dengue is Marianne Comparé. She's director and co-founder of the International Society for Neglected Tropical Diseases. Marianne, thank you so much for joining us so early in the morning for you. I know you're based in the UK. Tell me, is dengue an increasing problem worldwide?
Good morning. And yes, certainly it's not just a problem now. It's been increasing faster and faster over the last 40 to 50 years. In the 70s, you found dengue in about 9 countries, and now it's prevalent in about 130. So it's certainly has been growing very rapidly, but what's most concerning is 2023 broke many records in terms of numbers of infections and intensities of outbreaks, and 2024 already is beating those extremely high numbers. So it's definitely something that needs to be kept a close eye on.
Now, we've just heard this warning about the tiger mosquitoes in Europe. Is that a known concern, or is that quite a surprise that we're finding mosquitoes that far north?
Well, to those who've been tracking them, European surveillance agencies and local health authorities, it's not a surprise. The mosquito first appeared in Albania and Italy as far back as the 80s and the 90s. But the fact that it is now found in, as you mentioned, 13 countries, but also in parts of those countries like France, where it's not the very warm south, but all the way up north in much more temperate areas, has been a concern. And that's what, you know, a lot of authorities are keeping a very close eye on.
How about closer to home around the Middle East, you know, specifically the UAE? Is dengue found more here as because of global warming?
So absolutely. There have been anecdotal reports of dengue cases in a region, the Middle East, which was historically kind of not really favorable to the mosquito in terms of the environmental conditions. But this mosquito is extremely adaptable. Some people call it invasive. And so it's finding a home in lots of very new places, whether that be kind of geographically, but also in higher altitudes, by the way. That said, you need a mosquito, you also need the virus to be present. So another factor to really look closely at is perhaps migration of people coming from areas where dengue has been established more historically, bringing the virus into areas where the mosquito is prevalent, and then you kind of line up the perfect storm to encourage and precipitate any possible dengue cases and outbreaks.
Now, I've talked a lot about it, you know, spreading because of climate change, but what is it about the changing climate that makes certain places more palatable to the dengue spreading mosquito?
So that's a great question, because it's surprise, quite complicated. On the one hand, a warming climate or a changing climate is certainly increasing the temperature range at which the mosquito thrives. It's also bringing in weather events. So you mentioned the floodings that happened recently. Mosquitoes breed in water, even in very small amounts of water. But also droughts can encourage people to store water, and that would then also create breeding grounds for mosquitoes. At the same time, viruses also react to temperatures. They can be quite sensitive to that. So whilst there's definitely been an association with warming climates and the expansion of the suitable habitats for mosquitoes, there's also quite a lot of research gaps on really understanding exactly those mechanisms.
Okay, so now we've sort of established that we need to worry about it. How do you catch it? And can people catch it from each other?
So that's the good news. You can't directly catch it from someone who's been infected. You would need a mosquito of the right species to bite someone who's been infected with that particular virus to then go in and bite someone else. So that's on the one hand the good news, that it can't be transmitted person to person. But on the other hand, that also means that if one person has dengue and there's the right mosquitoes around, it's quite likely that lots of those nearby will also be infected. So most cases of dengue will be what's called asymptomatic. You might not even realize you have it. So that's, again, both a plus and a negative, because, of course, we don't want people to feel ill. But at the same time, you could actually be carrying and then transmitting dengue unwittingly.
I suppose this can all be stopped if people don't get bitten by mosquitoes. So if we are religiously using ant repellent, then you're in a good place.
Absolutely. The best thing people could do is, as you say, put a barrier between the mosquitoes and themselves by using repellent, by wearing covering with long sleeves or long trousers, and also just keeping an eye on those small amounts of water, the containers that they may find around their home, and keeping an eye on that, making sure they're emptied. There are vaccines available, and there are more on the way. So the future, the horizon is looking positive, but at the same time, this is really a disease that is progressing at an unprecedented rate and in very new areas as well.
What is the treatment for dengue? You mentioned there that you can get a vaccine for it. I presume that's a fairly simple injection. How about treatment? Is there a cure? I mean, it's a virus. Viruses are always quite tricky, aren't they?
Absolutely. I'm sorry to say at the moment there isn't a cure, but research is well underway to try and deliver that in the coming years. How a clinician might treat for dengue is really to keep an eye on the patient, have very careful management of the symptoms, making sure anyone who has one of the stronger forms of dengue is kept hydrated, under close scrutiny in a medical setting. Thankfully, though, most cases, whilst being quite debilitating and exhausting, can be managed at home. So it's kind of a mix of what we already know, painkillers, rest, keeping well hydrated, and also if it were to escalate, then a very careful supervision under a medical setting.
Fantastic to speak to you, Marianne. Thank you so much for your time this morning. Really interesting to talk through the potential dangers posed by dengue. It sounds like it is. It's very reassuring to hear there that it isn't necessarily dangerous, that you can receive treatment for it, and also that there are vaccines available. Marianne Comparé, director and co-founder at the International Society for Neglected Tropical Diseases. Thank you very much indeed for your time.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hey there, welcome back to your Agenda programme. Now, are you planning a trip to Europe this summer? We are, as a family. We are going to be going to Greece. And I'm going to be packing the mozzie repellent. Normally, you don't have to in Europe if you're by the sea. But it turns out that health authorities in Europe are actually warning of a rising prevalence of dengue on the continent. And that's actually due to an invasive species of mosquitoes. They're called the tiger mosquitoes. And they can now be found in 13 countries in the EU, including France, Spain and Greece. Apparently, it's all due to climate change. We were just speaking to Marianne Comparé, who explained, you know, what the conditions are that make it more appealing to these mosquitoes. Of course, here in the UAE, the authorities worked really hard after those recent historic storms to clear the standing flood water, which, you know, makes for perfect breeding ground for the mosquitoes. But with World Dengue Day being marked tomorrow, public health campaigners say that it really is the perfect opportunity for public health officials to raise awareness of the disease. But what is it actually like to have dengue? Now, last month, I actually spoke to somebody who caught it recently, Australian expat Lucy Cormack. Now, she wasn't the only person who caught it. Her husband did as well. She came into the studio to basically tell her story.
In late January this year, both my husband and I were diagnosed and spent a few nights in hospital with dengue fever.
I mean, goodness me. So that was not as a result of the mosquitoes that came after the superstorm and the floods. But did you catch it here in Dubai?
Yes, we did. So we'd gone home to Australia for Christmas, and we'd been back in the country here in Dubai for about a month. And we live on Palm Jumeirah, and it was beautiful weather that time of year. So of course we had our balcony doors open. We were enjoying the breeze, and it was a lovely time of year. The temperatures were amazing, but of course that also meant there were a lot of mosquitoes. I'm very used to being bitten by mosquitoes, especially in Sydney. I get eaten alive, but I had been getting some mosquito bites here, but. We had no idea that you could even get dengue fever in Dubai or in the UAE at all. And so it was quite a shock when we came down with it.
How did you know you'd come down with it? I have to admit, I think like lots of people listening, I have no idea what dengue really means, you know, when you catch it.
Yeah. So look, it was really interesting because it's got a 5-day incubation period. So, you know, much like they used to talk about with COVID, you would catch COVID, but perhaps your symptoms wouldn't come on for a few days. It's similar with dengue fever. The day that we sort of went to the hospital was the day of the Burj to Burj half marathon. And my husband and I had both run the half marathon. And, you know, we were really, you know, feeling great. We were both pretty active people and we both made really good times and it was a good day. We got to the end of the race, of course, we were exhausted and, you know, we felt really crummy. And that night, you know, starting to get a bit of chills and feeling not that well, but that's quite normal after you run a big race. But it was that night about sort of 2 or 3 in the morning, I woke up and my husband was just absolutely shivering and he was freezing cold. And he had a temperature though of about 41 degrees, gosh, which was really scary.
Yeah.
And he could, you know, he was shivering such that it was just really terrifying. And so I called an ambulance. They came extraordinarily quickly and we were straight to the hospital and I was sort of starting to feel much worse as well. Once we were at the hospital, they started taking blood tests of my husband and then subsequently they took mine and the key sort of signal for dengue is that your platelet count in your blood is really low. And so his platelet counts were really dropping lower and lower, and so that's sort of the indicator. And it was at that point that the doctor said, look, you've got dengue fever.
What are the implications of that? Can it be treated?
Basically, it's just simply treating you through the symptoms. So there's no, I understand there is one vaccine that can be accessed in the UK, I'm told, but it's not widely accessible around the world and we don't have that. But the symptoms that you have are insane, well, fever up and down and really erratic fever, aches and pains, nausea, you just can't eat for days. So you lose complete, all your appetite is gone and things taste funny. You have this awful symptom of your gums bleeding. I really went through that. So I would wake up in the morning and, you know, you would really have to sort of go and spit out because your gums would be bleeding. So it can be really, really, it really affects all
awful
of you.
Awful. I mean, you said you were at home. Were you sent home to recover from it?
Or? So the first couple of days I was still at home. They said, look, you've got it, but you're not quite sick enough. We're not going to admit you yet. My husband was really ill and that was really scary. So I was driving each day. He spent about 5 nights in total in hospital. I spent about 1 or 2. And the reason I got admitted subsequently was from dehydration because, you know, it's so hard to drink and to have enough water and to eat. And one of the days I was there, I passed out in the hospital because I was so dehydrated. And so it's just the overall fatigue and feeling unwell. And that lasted for such a long time. It took us many weeks. I sort of bounced back slightly quicker, but my husband, you know, it took him weeks and weeks and just, you know, walking places, moving about, let alone exercising again.
So can you tell, I mean, this is a bit weird, but can you tell which mosquito bite it was that got you? Or do you remember? I mean, we're going to speak to an expert on the mosquitoes and the disease next, but, you know, was there a particular stripy-legged mosquito? Do you know what I mean? Can you identify it?
No. Well, we certainly didn't.
No.
And, I mean, as I understand it, a mosquito that is carrying one of the strains of dengue will have bitten an infected person. It's carrying that strain, and then that same mosquito will bite another person, and that's what transfers it. So the doctor said to us, in all likelihood, you guys have caught this in your apartment and you've been bitten by the same mosquito in that sort of confined space.
Yeah, so it bit one of you and then it was like, oh, they look tasty too kind of scenario. And how about the legacy now? Because, of course, if this was back in January, how are you feeling now in May? Do you feel like you've both fully recovered?
Yes, we do now. But certainly it took quite a few months. Your sleep patterns are really disrupted. We found that, you know, you have very light sleep. It was hard to sort of rest and have that sort of deep sleep that you would have. You know, I mean, I think we're all quite attuned to our sleep patterns now that we're all wearing Garmins and Apple Watches and things.
Yeah.
But certainly you didn't need a watch to tell you that you weren't having deep, productive sleep. And I think also the funny extra symptom that we weren't really expecting was sort of in the subsequent months, our hair sort of falling out. And the doctor did say to us, look, yes, that can happen for a period that your hair will just shed a lot more quickly and more frequently. It was particularly noticeable for my husband. I mean, I'm as a woman with long hair, my hair's all over the house anyway, but even his hair sort of just kind of all over the place.
It sounds like a properly slightly creepy tropical disease, if I'm honest. The way you were describing it, the bleeding gums, the hair falling out.
Look, I'm not recommending it. Yeah. You want to do everything you possibly can to avoid this. But it's great that it's being talked about and the government's, you know, taking these actions, because it is something that I think with increasing globalization and climate change, this is just a factor for going to be a factor for so much of the world.
And when you went to the hospitals here, did you feel like the doctors were totally on top of it? They knew what it was, they knew how to treat it.
We had that experience, yes. And they told us that they were seeing an increase in cases and that they were having more presentations.
That is Lucy Cormack, Australian expat who lives here in Dubai, who caught the disease along with her husband about a couple of months ago, it must have been now. Very interesting there to hear about her experience.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hey there, welcome back to the show. Right, it's been long awaited. It's been long anticipated. There must be some music associated with it, actually. I forgot to get that. But it is Euro 2024. It is finally here. The tournament kicks off tonight in Munich at 11 p.m. our time. And the hosts, Germany, are going to be taking on Scotland, which is interesting. Chris McCarty will be busy. The competition is going to last for a month, concludes on Sunday the 14th of July at the Olympiastadion in Berlin. It is the first time that Germany has hosted the tournament since reunification. And it is, even though it's over in Europe, people are such football fans here that they are talking about it a great deal here. And I know that lots of people are going to be listening as well. Isa, thank you for this. So mentally prepare yourselves to hear that an awful lot. I am joined now on the line by Saif Ruby. He's a FIFA licensed football agent. He's an entrepreneur. He is very, very tapped in to the football world, not least because he's the owner of a premium sports lounge right here called Players House. It's on the Palm. And he joins me now on the line. Saif, lovely to have you with us. Why are the Euros such a big deal?
I mean, look, it's been a long season, but I guess people can never have enough of football. And obviously the Euros is the biggest thing in the European football calendar. I mean, we just had the Champions League on a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, now it's another month of football bonanza. You've got the Copa America, you know, you've got the Olympics, and then you've got the Premier League starting straight after. So it's really nonstop the whole summer.
Robbie and Chris, loving it. You're loving it.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's quite exciting. Germany on home soil, England with their exciting batch of, you know, top young talent, trying to bring it home finally. So, you know, it's going to be a lot of excitement.
Yeah, you mentioned a couple of the teams there, and I understand that for once England is looking pretty good. You know, some people are saying that it might even be England's to win. Of course, I am going to say that as a British person. But who is actually playing? Because obviously there isn't space for every single European country, but there's a fair number of them involved, aren't there?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty much most of the European countries that are qualified are in it. I think Georgia, it's their first ever appearance in the Euro Cup as well. So it's quite exciting for them. And obviously they've got a lot of technical players. So it should be quite exciting. You know, then you've got dark horses like Serbia that people think, you know, have a chance of making it through quite far down the line. So, you know, anything can happen. Obviously, Portugal have won it in the past. Greece have won it in the past. I think it should be very, very exciting. France, you know, lots of top teams.
How about the players? Because obviously, we know the players from their teams, you know, the sort of Manchester United type teams. But this is when they go back to their countrymen. And you often have one of those like crazy star players, you know, alongside some quite normal people.
Yeah, I mean, look, as we mentioned, like even, you know, with Georgia have a top player. It's one of the best wingers in Europe that plays for Napoli. So that's going to be good for them. But I think generally, to be honest, the level and quality of players in football has gone up so much over the years that, you know, every team has some good players. And sometimes it's not about the players, it's about the team. Obviously, that's going to be shown to see how England perform, because, you know, they arguably have the best batch of players. But whether they're going to have the best team, only time will tell.
Yeah, so at the moment, I'm looking at who's favourite to win. And it says England 7-2 and France 4-1, and then host Germany a 5-1. How much of a home sort of benefit do you get when you're hosting one of these things? Does it give the team a bit of a push up? You know, does it encourage them to win?
Yeah, I mean, look, in the last Euros, obviously England should have won it because most of their games were in England. And obviously in the end, they fell a bit short. Now, Germany, obviously, they have a lot of amazing players. Toni Kroos, who's been unbelievable this season, he's retiring after this tournament. Real Madrid and Germany legend. So, you know, obviously you've got players like Toni Rüdiger from Real Madrid as well, who are also top players. Massalia from Bayern Munich. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. So for Germany, obviously, they're under massive pressure to perform and bring it home for themselves in Germany. So let's see.
So are you expecting, you know, the various sports establishments around town to be full? You know, is there a massive enthusiasm for football, even though it's Euro football? Where are you going to be watching it?
I'll be watching it in Players House. Obviously, we just opened on the Palm Jumeirah a few months ago. But I mean, I think there's a lot of really cool and nice activations going on all around Dubai, offering different things for everybody. And look, I think England-Scotland games, I think, will be very, very busy. But look, also there's a lot of Europeans in Dubai who are going to be cheering, you know, their home nations on in the tournament. So I think it's one of those things where actually it brings everybody together, you know, with all the different nationalities that live in the country. And I think with the offerings that there are in Dubai, it's going to be amazing. And I think it's going to be a lot of fun for the next month, for sure.
Yeah, I know a lot of offices that are doing sweepstakes. I was chatting to, I mean, would you believe it, one of the mums at school yesterday who was saying how she's picked, I don't know whether it was Sweden, or she's picked a country out of the sweepstake that's unlikely to win. But I know that that isn't just one way in which lots of people are getting involved. And of course, it is very hot at the moment. So why not stay indoors and watch a great deal of sport? Saif Ruby, thank you so much for your time. FIFA licensed football agent, entrepreneur, owner of the Players Lounge, the Players House on the Palm, and someone who is going to be kept very busy over the next month. So do get in touch. Tell me where you're going to be watching the Euros. Of course, the team here, they're going to be going down to the Agenda, which is just around the corner. I love that it's called the Agenda, but that is where Chris McCarthy and Robbie Greenfield will be spending most of the next month. So you can always catch them down there as well. You're listening to Georgia Tolley here on The Agenda, and I'm going to turn my attention to smoking. I'm a bit smug about smoking because I managed to give up about 5 years ago, and I've not really gone back to it. It was quite tricky giving up, and I definitely sort of became addicted gradually. You know, at first I was like, oh, no, I only have one night out. Then before you know it, you're, you know, popping out in the middle of the day when you're having a stressful day. And then before you know it, you own a packet instead of just, you know, trying to nick them off other people. And I think that's probably one of the reasons why I was interested by this study. It's a new one, and it shows that the GCC region is falling behind global efforts to curb smoking. It's researchers for a non-for-profit. It's called Foundation for a Smoke-Free World. So, you know, you can tell which side they're on. And they looked at the impact of smoking across seven nations, including the UAE, Pakistan, Egypt, Lebanon, Jordan, Kuwait, and Saudi. And they found that out of the nearly 400 million people in the region, 61 million adults use tobacco. And here is the bald fact. Nearly 400,000 people die prematurely every year as a result. Now, while the prevalence of smoking is coming down in some areas around the world, it is only forecast to fall by 2% by 2025 in the Middle East. And researchers say that is not enough. Joining me now to discuss how this figure could be raised is Andrea Jabari-Leinberger. Now, she's Assistant Director for Tobacco Research at New York University, Abu Dhabi. As ever, Andrea, really lovely to have you join us on the line. Can you tell me a little bit more about the picture here in the UAE specifically? How many people smoke here? What's the percentage? What's the age? You know, men or women, all of that type of thing.
Sure. Thank you for having me, Georgia. Always a pleasure. So maybe before I actually get to the figures here in the UAE, I just wanted a point of clarification. The report that was mentioned in this news article and that you referenced, it was put out by some independent researchers. Yes, from the lead author actually used to be with the Foundation for a Smoke-Free World. It's now been renamed the Global Action on Tobacco. I will just point out that this organization is 100%. Funded by the tobacco industry. And so it is, I would Wow. take some of what they say worth a grain of salt. Yes, it's a Philip Morris International funded foundation.
That is interesting. That's interesting Yeah. because they pitch themselves as people who want to give up. We're trying to encourage people to give up smoking.
Right. And I guess what you can see, though, in some of the conclusions that they come to in their report is not necessarily to give up nicotine, but to rather switch to other nicotine and what they call tobacco harm reduction products. And so I think that's quite telling in terms of their motivations for the conclusions in the report. Now, maybe to get to the answer of your question, what I would say is in the UAE, we're not doing too poorly. Some of the figures that are in this report have been taken from the WHO, and we can see the region as a whole, the entire Middle East region, which includes many countries, both within the GCC and outside of the GCC, but still in the Middle East. We are lagging behind global figures in terms of tobacco control efforts. And there are some projections that suggest that tobacco use rates may actually increase slightly in this region. But in terms of the UAE, national figures, which are based on data from 2018, so slightly outdated, show that the overall smoking rate in the UAE is about 9%. However, I would say this differs from subgroup to subgroup. So the research that I'm conducting, that we're conducting at New York University with our colleagues around the country, show that actually we have tobacco use rates among Emirati adults approaching about 30%.
That is high.
Yeah, so I think, you know, we are in the UAE, we're doing a number of things quite well across compared to other countries in the region, but more certainly can be done.
What, though? Because it is so difficult to dissuade people from smoking. I know that, I mean, obviously, I'm a mother of two young children, and therefore one of my preoccupations is to try and keep them away from vaping as they enter their teenage years. But how do you discourage people from taking up the habit?
So that's excellent. So in terms of the measures, so there's a framework called Empower that the WHO has put out. And there are some key steps. So the first one is monitoring. We definitely need to do a better job of monitoring tobacco use behaviors in the UAE and in the region in general. The last kind of comprehensive survey that we've done on adult tobacco use across the country, as well as youth tobacco use, is probably around 2017, 2018. We need more data because since then, you know, as you're well aware, we have newer products on the market. These so-called harm reduction products have exploded on the market in the UAE. And so we need to understand the use patterns. Protecting people from secondhand smoke and enforcing bans in public places, we certainly know that there are a number of measures that we've been doing. We definitely need to do more. And then making cessation services more widely available, I think, is another way that we definitely can improve, rates of quitting for people who want to quit.
Andrea Diabari-Leinberger, thank you so much for your time this morning. Really interesting to get to the bottom of that report and, of course, what more needs to be done. Andrea is Assistant Director for Tobacco Research at New York University, Abu Dhabi.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Eid holidays, perhaps you're about to jump on a flight now. Perhaps you're actually in the car on the way to the airport. Apparently the Maldives is a very popular destination this Eid. I wish I was going. It was just too expensive. I looked. I couldn't countenance it. Far too pricey. But we are going away for the summer. That's one of the reasons, really. Like, it's so soon that we're going away for the summer that, you know, you can't do two holidays back to back. It's ridiculous. And when I was booking my flight back to the UK to see the family, I can honestly say it didn't cross my mind in any way at all how eco-friendly it would be. Didn't think about offsetting the air miles. Didn't buy any trees. I mean, it literally didn't cross my mind. Did it occur to you when you were booking your flight? Does it occur to you? I'd be really interested to know. Can we do a bit of a spot check here? Like, I know everyone's really busy and you're driving to and fro, but if you just write yes or no, then that would be amazing. 4001, or you can WhatsApp me on 04871 5500. Might even do a survey on Instagram at DubaiEye1038FM. I'll do that in the break. I mean, you can add a bit more stuff if you want to than yes and no. But I'd be really interested to hear from you because we all know that flights are insanely expensive at the moment. In fact, producer Jen found some sort of crazy headline that suggested they were up like 300% this Eid or something like that. And so as a consequence, the last thing you want to do is add a little bit extra to pay off your carbon credits. And I bet that's really causing problems, actually. I bet the conservation community are worried about that. But it does seem that the aviation sector themselves at least are making some modest gains in their mission to make flying greener. Most recently, in fact, in the last 24 hours or so, Emirates have announced that they've been powering flights from Singapore with sustainable aviation fuel, known as SAF. And it is all part of the airline's agreement with a company called Neste. They say apparently 3.3 million litres of blended SAF have been integrated into the fueling system at Changi Airport, and they've been doing it over the last few weeks. Apparently, the SAF is produced from sustainably sourced and 100% renewable waste. They also stick in residue raw materials, including used cooking oil and animal fat waste. It doesn't sound very official, does it? But it is. It is. And obviously, you know, they go, by the way, anything aviation has to be very, very strictly regulated. So it clearly works and it clearly does the deal. And it does mean that it reduces the life cycle carbon emissions by up to 80% compared to using conventional jet fuel. That's what Emirates says. Well, we wanted to find out a whole bunch more. So last night, I actually caught up with Alexander Cooper. Now, he's vice president of renewable aviation business at that oil company, Neste. And he started by talking me through how the sustainable fuel is being used.
It is a step forward indeed. We are now sort of not only we supply Emirates in Amsterdam Airport, but also now in Singapore. And we are very happy to sort of continue on that journey to find new locations and supply Emirates with our sustainable aviation fuel. It is a very good partnership, which is not only based on the locations where we deliver fuel to them, but also we work together on many fronts, including regulation in international bodies such as ICAO and in other places. So it's a really broad partnership, which shows that Emirates is really, really serious about the sustainability and the decarbonization agenda.
What are the current hurdles that both you and Emirates are facing at the moment? Because there's obviously this enthusiasm to use SAF. What are the issues we're facing as a world in many ways, or as an industry?
I think one of the main issues is that SAF is not available everywhere in the world. So first of all, there's enough SAF in general. Neste is producing a whole lot of it. We are sort of now have a production capacity of 1 million tons. We will be at 1.5 million tons by the end of the year. And just to put it in context, 2021, the global SAF production of any supplier was about 80,000 tons. So we're now kind of in the million, going beyond that million. And in 2026, we'll be over 2 million tons. That's huge. So there's been a huge ramp up in SAF production capacity. There are airports where we have access to as Neste, such as Amsterdam and Singapore, where we can deliver to our customers. There are airports where we don't have access or that don't incentivize the use of SAF. For instance, Amsterdam will give you an incentive to use SAF, and that, of course, makes it more accessible to the airline. It's a very smart way to increase the use of SAF, and also that is why the airport of Amsterdam has become one of the primary SAF hubs in the world.
What do airports need to do to be able to become SAF hubs? Do they need completely different systems and storage and tankers and all the rest of it?
No, they don't. And that's really the good thing about SAF. It's what we call a drop-in solution. And that's a very technical term. But what it basically means is that you can use the existing infrastructure, the existing aircraft, the existing engines. And the SAF that basically gets put in the system is specified jet fuel. There's no difference in a way. And you can just use it with the existing infrastructure. That makes it really a lot cheaper than if you had to build a different infrastructure. A lot of people, when they hear about SAF, think that you have to build new pipelines and new tanks and new trucks to bring it to the aircraft. That is actually not the case. What happens is it goes into the airport storage. It's mixed with all the other fuel that is there because it has the same basically chemical properties, the SAF blend. So the SAF blend, maybe to explain this, is a mix between neat SAF, so basically the synthetic blend component, and conventional fuel. Now, the bottom line, the SAF that we deliver into the airport is basically specified jet fuel. You can just mix it with everything else. It goes into the hydrogen system, and then it basically goes into the planes. That makes it super easy, and as opposed to new other energy forms, such as hydrogen, which might be a thing towards the end of the decade, maybe, where you need to build a complete infrastructure, this is going to make it very expensive, whereas SAF is very practical.
You're clearly ramping up the production of your SAF. How are you doing that and where are you doing it?
We've been ramping up quite a bit. And of course, Neste has been starting probably 10 to 20 years earlier than everybody else. For some reason, the then CEO and the leadership thought sustainability is a thing. Well, you have to know that Neste is a Finnish company and Finnish people tend to be very, very close to nature. I think they really embraced that sustainability idea. And then 20 years ago, someone in Neste thought, why don't we go into sustainable production, which wasn't a thing back then. It wasn't mainstream back then. They developed this technology, which is patented and it's a Neste technology. This is how we produce our SAF today. And then they basically started producing it. And now we are really at industrial scale production. That makes us the largest producer in the world. And we are really one of the few ones that really have a big 1 million plus production capacity. I think nobody else really has that at this point. And it's because we started early. And of course, also we have very good supply chains for making sure that we get sustainable feedstock as well. Now, that's how Neste became what it is today. We have a refinery in Finland, obviously, because it's a Finnish company. And then we have a huge refinery in Singapore. And we just really opened it last year, started producing. Now it's really kind of running and producing on a kind of day-to-day basis with these huge volumes. And then we also have a production site in Rotterdam in the Netherlands, which we are now expanding. And then in 26, we expanded even further. So we invest another $2.6 billion. So what I'm trying to say, this is a huge amount of money that goes into this. It's not an easy thing that you just take an amount of money, take $100,000 or whatever, and then put it into a refinery. Singapore is $1.6 billion. I mean, this is really a huge amount of money you need to put in there to be able really to then produce these volumes. So Neste is, of course, supporting the airlines because, on the other hand, the airlines said they want to go net zero by 2050. For that, they need 400 million tons of SAF. So we are now really sort of on track to ramping up the volume in a way that if you extrapolate this and you keep going like that, if the industry keeps producing these volumes, we will be able to help the airlines reach this goal of decarbonizing.
Can you tell me where the next one's going to be? I mean, it's such a huge amount of money. I imagine that's probably a market-moving decision.
Yeah, and also I think it's important to understand Neste is unlike the big oil majors, it's a rather small company. We've got 5,000 people. It's not a huge company. I think about a quarter of these 5,000 people are work in development and research and engineering. So it's a very kind of engineering-driven company. But it's a rather small company. And the fact that we put billions into these refineries is quite remarkable, I think. Singapore is now running well. Then, of course, we have this next expansion program in Rotterdam, which is going to be completed in 2026, which is another couple of billion. I think for now, that's kind of the pipeline that we have. And I think it brings us to a really good place in supplying large volumes. And then, of course, there's other things we're looking at. But at the moment, this is kind of the lighthouse projects that we have.
So how soon do you think we could see Neste SAF in Dubai Airport being pumped into planes?
At the moment, you can bring the SAF from Singapore to Emirates or to the Gulf region or to the US for that matter. I know that people feel concerned that you have to transport it a long part of the journey, but actually, as a matter of fact, because these ships are so big and so efficient, the CO2 impact of this transport is actually minimal. So it's really still very sustainable, even if you have to transport it, you know, between two regions. We, of course, want to access Dubai Airport. That is something we're working on. And either be it through partners, be it in our own right. Dubai is of course, one of the global aviation hubs. It is quite amazing to see what Emirates and Dubai Airport have achieved in the last 20, 30 years. And for us, being present at one of these global aviation hubs is very important. So we really want to be there. We want to support the airlines there. And it is something that doesn't happen overnight, but we're working on it. We're very keen to expand our presence in Dubai and in the region.
Alexander Cooper, their vice president of the renewable aviation business sector at Neste, bringing us up to date there with those Emirates flights. And up next, we're going to be discussing one of the more unconventional ways of creating sustainable aviation fuel. I think it's fair to say that people are trying every single variety of source fuel. In fact, the next company that we're going to talk to is actually making fuel. And I feel slightly self-conscious saying this on the radio, which shows how squeamish we can be. But yeah, they're actually making fuel out of human feces. That's next.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello there. Welcome back to The Agenda. Now, aviation is responsible for 2% of global energy-related CO2 emissions. But the reality is that we all just want to keep travelling. Lots of people getting in touch with me saying that literally no one is offsetting their carbon, you know, offsetting with carbon credits. You know, no one's gone and figured out how many emissions their flight will cost and therefore planted enough trees to make that better. But the sustainability scientists are working on it. There's lots of talk about using biofuels made out of plants, but in turn that could end up pushing up food prices. Another alternative is used cooking oil, but there just isn't enough of that to go around. So we were very interested. We heard of the UK company that's apparently making fuel out of human poo. Yep, despite the sort of ick of the subject, we had to get them on. A little earlier, I spoke to CEO of Firefly Green Fuels. His name is James Highgate, and he explained to me where the idea of these poo-powered planes came from.
So we've worked in sustainable biofuels for over 20 years, and one of the biggest challenge areas, if not the biggest challenge area, is finding suitable feedstock. Like you say, it needs to be a feedstock that's abundant. It needs to be a feedstock that is fully biogenic, so from has no fossil components in it, which actually did quite quickly lead us to sewage. You know, it's everywhere. We're all contributing to the feedstock supply every day, some people twice a day. You know, there's a lot of it around, and it's global. The big challenge with it is that it's wet. And I think that's where the innovations we've been working on to actually make it a very efficient way to convert that into what is a true drop-in hydrocarbon fuel, but without the fossil carbon, is so interesting. And I think offers really good potential, not only in the UK, but actually in areas such as the UAE, where there aren't very many other sort of biological feedstocks available for use.
I still don't sort of get the scientific link between human poo and how you make it fuel. It's probably because I don't understand, you know, the table, you know, the CO2 table.
Fine. All right. Just to put it, A very simple way to look at it is, you know, fossil fuels. Fossil fuels are you know, biological material that's broken down over many millions of years under, you know, under high pressures and sort of moderate temperatures in the Earth's crust, and you end up with producing a various range of fossil products such as, you know, such as hydrocarbon fuels, coal, etc. What we're doing is optimizing a process which actually uses the water in that material, put it under a high pressure, and it basically, water is kind of a weird chemical anyway, but you put it under high pressure, it acts quite aggressively, breaks down the material there into what we found is what we call a bio crude, which is very similar to a fossil crude, and a biochar. And the biochar is a, you know, the other, you've got, you know, some carbon in there and other minerals, etc. And that's actually quite a useful co-product because that can be used as a soil improver. So basically, it's not too dissimilar to what happens in the Earth's crust. We do it in seconds rather than millions of years.
I mean, it sounds a fantastic solution out here in the UAE. And I know that, for example, the country is very enthusiastic about finding sustainable aviation fuels. Obviously, it's a trade hub, so and an airport hub. So if we manage to figure out here, then lots of planes could come in and refuel here, for example.
Yeah.
Could it be scaled? You know, what are the hurdles at the moment?
So, yes, you know, basically we're in this because we truly believe this can be scaled and it can be a global solution for decarbonizing aviation. So when you actually look at the downstream part of the process, it's very similar to oil refining. There's some clever catalysts, etc. we're using. There are some different things because the crude is slightly different, but that's something where there is a known base of engineers that can build these technologies. And the challenge is really sort of upstream is securing the feedstock supply. We're very focused on the UK at the moment, where we believe we can. You know, the UK has about, but if you go top down, it's about 57 million tons of sewage a year. The product we use is at the end of the process is about 8 million tons of that. And so, you know, there's potentially a lot of SAF that can be made. A little rule of thumb is each person could be able to produce about 4 to 5 litres of sustainable aviation fuel per year from their sewage. So it's quite an easy way to scale up to the numbers. In addition to the sustainable aviation fuel, you do end up with a number of fuels. So you have like a gasoline fraction, etc., as you would do if you're refining a fossil crude. We already do have a very solid offtake agreement with Wizz Air, who are also a local airline for you guys and expanding in the region. That's for 525,000 tons of fuel, which is fantastic. It's great to see that airlines such as Wizz Air and these are ultra low cost airlines are seeing this as in sustainability as a real something real that has to happen and are committing and financially committing to make these things grow. So
I didn't realise that you had Wizz Air on board. That adds a whole nother local angle to the story, which I was unaware of. That's fantastic news. So Wizz Air are buying fuel from you or research or paying for research in your project?
Oh, yeah. No. Wizz Air are an investor in the company, and we have a very solid offtake agreement with them for a lot of fuel over a significant period of time, with the aim to use that to help finance the first of a kind facility. So we are, this is actually all quite carefully planned out, and we'll be hearing more news about this first of a kind facility soon in the UK. But yes, this is very replicable, and yes, we do have an eye on the region as somewhere where we should be doing it, and a large customer already there who's looking to grow in the region using this sustainable fuel.
And that's James Highgate, who's the CEO of Firefly Green Fuels, bringing us up to date on a rather unusual sustainable solution.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Welcome back to the show. And we have been discussing aviation a bit on the programme this morning, but mostly in terms of the types of fuel that we're using and whether or not anyone is giving any thought at all to sort of offsetting their flights, if you're offsetting yours, I'd love to hear from you, 4001, or you can WhatsApp me on 0487155500. As a sort of vague taking the temperature of the nation test, I would say that so far no one has, because no one has messaged me in to say yes. But what about the cost of our holidays? Let's take a look at flight prices now, because Jennifer Crichton's been checking out the big travel picture ahead of this afternoon's big Eid breakaway. Jen, it looks like there aren't really going to be any bargains to be had, are there?
No. Interestingly, while nobody's been texting saying they're offsetting their flight, someone did text saying that they're well into the idea of teleportation, which, looking at the prices, might not be the daftest of ideas, to be honest. Do you remember this from earlier this month at the IATA conference in Dubai? This was Sir Tim Clark, and at the time he was talking about how consumers should feel about flight prices at the moment.
The margins that we make as a business, and I'm not playing the victim here, and I don't want people to get boxes of tissues out or play the violins, but the fact of the matter is, it's been an industry which has become so hugely efficient over the last 50 years. It is quite amazing that ticket prices are where they are today. And I think the value for money proposition that the consumers have had the benefit of for many decades is something that is one of those hidden bits of the narrative.
Hang on a second. Is he trying to say that flights are reasonable?
Yes. And that was 2 weeks ago. And I remember when I played you that clip, we both sort of went,
bold. Bold. Yeah. Coming out fighting, Sir Tim. You do that.
Yeah. We were both surprised then. Now, looking at the prices, I'd say it's safe to say that he's maybe slightly off kilter with where anyone trying to book a flight today would be feeling, because we saw a headline earlier suggesting prices on some routes out of Dubai are up as much as 300% this Eid break. Now, I caught up earlier with Rick and Sheth. He's the assistant vice president at Musafir, and he told us, yeah, to be fair, prices do always rise at this time of year.
It is this time of the year where everyone is looking for some kind of a destination that they can escape for this Eid break of 4 days. And honestly, reports of flight prices skyrocketing during peak travel times like Eid breaks aren't uncommon. During holidays or other peak travel periods, airlines often raise prices due to the increased demand. And of course, limited seat availability and last minute bookings also contribute to higher prices. And of course, one of the other reasons is that there are a lot of travel companies who pre-buy these seats in order to provide cost-effective holiday packages to customers. So if you're planning to travel during Eid, it's generally advisable to book your flights well in advance to secure better rates.
Which is good advice a couple of months ago, but
yeah, not much help for us now. I think if you haven't booked a flight now, I think you're not going away, let's be honest.
Basically. And I mean, while he's right that prices do always go up around now, it does seem to be quite extreme this year. Now, there was one travel agent that I spoke to who said he was too busy to join us on the show today because, and I quote, "I have never experienced demand like this in a decade working here." Now, he said he was advising clients shocked by prices from Dubai to consider flying from Sharjah or Abu Dhabi instead, or to fly at off-peak times to try and make some savings where they can. But he said even then, the savings have been very modest. He's got 80-odd outstanding requests sitting on his desk for today for people who are still trying to find flights out for this weekend. And he said basically the reason that they're still waiting is because flights at the moment are, to quote, crazy. So what can we do about it? As Rickon said, essentially we need a time machine.
To get a cheaper flight, I think you'll have to be a little smart or maybe even a little bit of flexibility in your travel dates. So for example, if you can probably start your holiday a couple of days after Eid starts, and then take a couple of days off your office and then try and see whether you're able to get good prices. Or the simplest option is just to plan in advance. Booking your flight tickets well in advance can help you secure lower prices, especially when it comes to popular routes and peak travel periods such as Eid.
Okay, so say we've given up on the subject of going away for Eid. And to be honest, if you haven't booked it yet, you are really late in the day. How about summer plans? Are they, if you book now, are you going to do better come July, August?
Yeah,
that's a no, isn't it?
Yeah, okay. Basically. Sorry. it does seem like they're unlikely to come down anytime soon. Now, it's not just the guys that we spoke to who are saying that. This morning on Business Breakfast, they spoke to the managing director of WeGo, Mamoun Hamadan. He said rises will potentially be even steeper after the Eid break.
Some good deals were still available in the market, I would say, even at the last minute level, especially for those top 10 nearby destinations, I would say. Prices didn't change much. I think it's an increase of like less than 10% on some of those destinations. For some of them, it's even 1 or 2%. Mm-hmm. I'm talking in the lens of Eid, but if we talk about summer, then it's different completely. I mean, prices are really high to some destinations. Place like Jordan, for example, increased year over year at the rate of 64%. Egypt is almost at 40%+. This year is technically cheaper than last year at the aggregate. So it's around 15 to 16% less than last year's airfares.
Yeah, thanks for that, Mamoun Hamadan from WeGo.
Yeah, managing director of WeGo. My goodness me, not a very good outlook. I wonder whether people have already managed to book their flight. The Agenda is live Monday to Friday from 10 a.m. till 1 p.m.